Well, very good morning. Welcome to this York City Church live stream on Sunday, the 10th of January, 2021. My name's Alan Rose. It's great to have you tuned in with us this morning. Before we get into anything else, we're going to hear the scripture reading from today with a little bit of help from a friend of mine.
In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void. And darkness covered the face of the deep, while the wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night.
And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day.
And God said, "Let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." So God made the dome, and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome, and it was so. God called the dome sky.
And there was evening, and there was morning the second day.
And God said, "Let the waters under the sky be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas.
And God saw that it was good.
Then God said, "Let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed of every kind, and trees of every kind bearing fruit with the seed in it.
And God saw that it was good.
And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day.
And God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky, to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons, and for days and years. And let them be lights in the dome of the sky, to give light upon the earth." And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness.
And God saw that it was good.
There was evening and there was morning, the fourth day.
And God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky." So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, of every kind with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind.
And God saw that it was good.
God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth."
And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day.
And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind.
And God saw that it was good.
Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth."
So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God he created them. Male and female he created them.
God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." God said, "See, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw everything that he had made, and indeed, it was very good.
And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day.
Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all their multitude. And on the seventh day God finished the work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all the work that he had done in creation.
So, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, or in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, as we heard there in the NRSV translation. I want to propose to you this morning for the first sermon of 2021, following on from our elders' conversation last week on the live stream. I want to propose to you that there could barely be a more relevant text for us to hear this January than Genesis chapter 1. The problem is that for the majority of us engaging with Genesis 1 today, perhaps for the majority of you who are watching this morning, you think that you already know Genesis chapter 1. And so the challenge then for this preacher and the first sermon in 2021, a very apt text for 2021, is to try and, I guess, defibrillate your imagination, to charge it up and bring some life-giving shocks into your imagination as we think about Genesis chapter 1. And to do that, I want to charge up three particular shocks, if you like, and talk about Genesis chapter 1 from three different angles or perspectives. The first one being history, the second being literature, and the third and final one being theology. In actual fact, history, literature and theology are three very key aspects for considering any text of the Bible. But for this morning, we're going to be focusing on Genesis chapter 1. Now, there are all kinds of shock jock preachers out there in the Christian world. And this morning, I do not want to contribute to shock jock preaching. So this sermon is not intended to be just somehow shocking and different for the sake of it. Rather, I want us to try and get to grips with some elements of Genesis chapter 1 that I believe are incredibly helpful for us as a church, as a people who are living in very uncertain times, who are faced with a pandemic and another lockdown and all that kind of stuff. What we've been doing, by the way, over the last term or so, is preaching from something called a lectionary. And it's something that I haven't given away as yet, but for the purposes of this morning, I'll just explain. A lectionary is a set of readings that has been put together by the church over many, many, many centuries. And the particular lectionary that we're using at the moment is the Lutheran Church's lectionary. There's nothing particularly extravagant or unusual about the Lutheran lectionary. It was just a good one that I felt was useful for us to use. And the idea is that you get through a lot of different scripture over the course of a year or years, and it's not just random. It's texts that are put together that help to interpret one another. Now, okay, we're just going to be focusing on one chapter of the Bible this morning, but in previous weeks you'd have noticed that there are a few different texts that have been read, and the sermon has sort of woven in elements from the different texts that have been in the readings. And that's all because we're using this lectionary. Partly it helps me as a preacher, taking up a lot of responsibility for preaching, because I don't have to recreate the wheel every week and find a new series with a flashy graphic or anything. There's actually a set of readings that the church has used for centuries that I get to lean into and find grace and God's voice in that for you. So that's what we're doing. So this morning, the lectionary text involved Genesis chapter 1. I think it's wonderful when we realize that here is this supply, this arranging of the text, the biblical text that has happened for centuries, that finds fresh voice and is profoundly relevant to us in all kinds of circumstances. And so here in 2021, we find Genesis 1 speaking profoundly and relevantly to us, given the challenges that we're facing. So it's not just a choice that I made. It just is one of those things where it seems that God, in his great wisdom and mercy, has so arranged reality that we get to hear this particular text on this particular Sunday. Right, okay, let's get back to Genesis 1. So we're going to be looking at history, literature, theology, three different angles, three defibrillator shocks for our imagination that will help us to understand what is going on in this rich, wonderful text that we, as Christians, probably know all about or think we know all about. So Genesis and history. Who wrote the book of Genesis? A lot of people traditionally would say Moses wrote the book of Genesis. But there's nothing actually to say that Moses wrote the book of Genesis. It doesn't ever have a little addendum, this was all written down by Moses. That's just something that has traditionally been assumed with precious little evidence. In actual fact, no one really knows who wrote the book of Genesis. Does it matter? Not particularly, no. But what is a little bit more secure is the understanding of when Genesis as a document was compiled or written down. There's a reasonable level of agreement amongst Old Testament scholars that Genesis, I guess as we know it, but perhaps not, but at least the beginning of the writing down of Genesis, took place at some time in the 6th century BCE. And that's very, very important because that dates the writing down of Genesis as a whole and Genesis 1 for our purposes to a context where Judah, the southern tribe of Israel, the southern half or part of Israel, if you like, had been deported to Babylon. They had been exiled to Babylon, and the temple in Jerusalem had been destroyed, and all that was left was a ragtag bunch of Israelites eking out an existence in a post-apocalyptic Judah. That's the kind of context that is going on. That's the kind of context into which Genesis 1 is compiled and written. Now, do I really need to spell out for us this morning how a text like Genesis 1 might prove to be very, very relevant for us then in 2021. You see, it matters a lot because Genesis as a whole and Genesis 1 in particular were written to address a particular set of issues and a particular set of problems. In a nutshell, this text is written to a people for whom their world has been turned upside down. It's written to a situation where the very core of Israel's identity and their common life together has been destroyed, has been flattened. It speaks to a context where the God-shaped heart of Israel's identity has been ripped out. When all of the hopes and the dreams and the expectations of God's people have been extinguished by Babylonian captivity, Genesis 1 speaks profoundly to that context. So whether you were one of the slaves now in Babylon, or one of the left behind trying to eke out a miserable existence, the message really for your life would seem the same. It's game over. And so Genesis 1 is this bombshell of reaffirmation, this bombshell of truth and hope and life and goodness that floods into all the shattered, broken places and brings hope and a sense of stability and a sense of order into what was a very, very disordered context. You see, Genesis 1 doesn't just describe what God did once upon a time, a long, long time ago. It's not just history, But it reaffirms that it was Israel's God who had created a world, and not just any world, but a world full of life and beauty and order and stability, a world that might sustain human life and worship. And if Israel's God had once spoken into the void and the darkness and the chaos and had created life, and that kind of life that could bring about worship, then he would surely, surely do it again. He would surely speak once more that Israel's darkness and void and chaos could be transformed by the life-giving, creative word of this God. See, as we face all kinds of chaos, as we face hopes and dreams again being turned upside down, as we face uncertainty, as we find ourselves shut down, locked down, homeschooling, facing all kinds of pressures, we need to hear again this word from God, this text, as it resonates down through millennia, through centuries. We find contextually we're not a million miles away from the first hearers and readers of Genesis chapter 1. And maybe we can find too, as we understand that this text was not written to address problems of evolutionary biology or cosmology, not that they can't be brought into conversation here, but there was a bigger picture and a theological issue that's being addressed. Can we hope in our God? Can we find means for life and faith again? Can we find some kind of order in a world that has gone chaotic on us? Yes, we can, because our God has spoken and created, and he can again speak and recreate and make all things new. And so the history of Genesis 1, or the history of its reception perhaps, its composition, more accurately, is helpful for us, okay? The second context, the second shock for our imagination is Genesis 1 and literature. A few weeks ago, I sat with our two interns and asked them the question, well, what is the Bible? And we talked about all kinds of different things, and one of the things that came up out of that, well, it's literature. It's written down language. It's signs and squiggles and dots and ink on paper, and you know, this is a literature, a literary piece. And one of the beautiful features of Genesis 1 is the artistry of the text. Now, we're reading Genesis 1 in the English language. It was written down in ancient Hebrew, and so there is, of course, a difference, and certain things and certain features of the text in Hebrew, perhaps we can maybe happily see, like maybe a little bit accidentally, but there is a real artistry and a real beauty about Genesis 1. It's actually very poetic. And one of the tragic things that happens in Christian interpretation in our world of Genesis 1 is that it becomes incredibly prosaic. It becomes about trying to prove that God was involved somehow, that the claims of modern science aren't all that there is to say about creation. And as we engage in that kind of discussion, we miss some of the beauty and the poetic and artistic beauty of Genesis 1. And it's actually true to say that the meaning of a text is not somehow separate from its form. And so the artistry and the beauty of Genesis 1 is part of its meaning. And one of the tragedies maybe of Western education is that we're taught to read in a particular way that extracts information from the text. And we don't need to worry about the form of the text. So long as we understand what we do with it, or we can pick out a few things and a few key words, well, that's all that matters. But arguably, Genesis 1 isn't supposed to be read like that. There is significant levels of shaping and beauty and artistry in this chapter. So as one example for you, the chapter is riddled with the number 7. 7! Or this chapter of the Bible is brought to you today by the number 7. And in the Hebrew text of Genesis, the first verse, Genesis 1 verse 1, consists of 7 words. And then Genesis 1 verse 2 consists of 14 words, which is 2 times 7. And then as you read through the chapter, God is mentioned 35 times, okay? And then earth 21 times, multiples of 7. And the phrases, it was so, and God saw that it was good, occur 7 times each. So if you were reading this as a Hebrew reader or speaker, then you would be alert to that, because in the Hebrew world, the number 7 was really, really important. Symbolically, it represented completion. It represented wholeness somehow. Now, as English speakers, we just go, 7, so. But when we get tuned into the reality of this artistry and the numbering and the rhythm and the meter of it all, we suddenly start to think, perhaps something's going on in this text that is more than just some factual statements. Perhaps there is something about the artistry that is meant to be doing something to us as we read the text of Genesis. Now, because of the way that we're taught to read, it can be hard for us to get our heads around this and learn to read an ancient text like the Bible in a new kind of way. But it's important to do that. It's important to do it because as we learn to read and spot these kinds of things, like the repetition of sevens, then perhaps we begin to see that God's creation has this inherent artistry to it. That the way that the world is formed is not just flat and cold, but actually has this sense of rhythm and purpose and repetition and art and glory to it. It highlights something, the number 7 in the text highlights something of the stability and the completion, the order of what God has done. But it also points forward to the climax of the creation account on the 7th day, where God blessed the Sabbath and rested. It's the only day that God created in Genesis 1 that is described as being blessed by God, actually. So all these sevens perhaps are there to highlight that sense of order and rhythm and the completion and the beauty and the artistry of it. But it's pointing to this completion and climax and blessing and rest. Maybe it's pointing to where creation is actually all going to. See, creation isn't just made and then it's there and that's it, and it kind of hangs there and it's autonomous and it does its thing and it's separate from what, and God is kind of every now and again dips into it to tweak something, to, you know, to raise up a leader here, to kind of cause an earthquake there or whatever it might be. It's all moving towards God. Creation comes from God. In the beginning, God speaks and there's creation, and it's all moving towards God in rest and blessing and Sabbath. Within this bit of Genesis, we see this whole movement of creation coming from God, returning to God. And for a people like the Judahites in exile in Babylon, wondering what has happened to God, our world has gone topsy-turvy, there is an affirmation that all things have come from God and are indeed returning to God. So no matter how crazy or upside down things seem to be in the present, things are moving towards a divinely appointed goal and purpose. To read, to recite, to reflect on Genesis 1, therefore, can become an act of worship in itself. It's an act of resistance, almost, towards the powers that appear to threaten God's creation and God's ordering of all things to himself. And the next time you get an opportunity, sit down and recite slowly Genesis 1. Read it through. Read it out loud as an act of worship. Use it as a liturgy. That's what it technically is, a liturgy, a way of using language and words in worship that affirm the order and the beauty and the createdness of all that is, a way of locating your life in this big picture of God's, a way of affirming that life is truly not upside down and out of control, but truly has God's artistry at the very heart of it. And as you do that, as you use this text as a liturgy, as a way of worshiping God, you find that you're actually participating in that order. The text does something in you and to you as you do it. It's a way of moving, perhaps, from freaking out to being at rest. And you know, that's one thing that we all have in common right now, isn't it? We're all somewhere on a sliding scale of anxiety, from being reasonably chilled out about how things are to really having a wobbly about it all. And Genesis 1 speaks to us and draws us into a participation in the ordered reality of God's creating of all things and the direction that all things are going towards rest, return to God. Make use of this text, eh? Of course, I've alluded to the fact that we can ask all kinds of questions about beginnings and origins and science, but the key thing for us as Christians is to receive Genesis 1 as scripture. We confess it as scripture. It's meaningful for us beyond just facts. It's a means for our engaging with God and fellowshipping with him and participating in his ways. Now, here's the final thing. Genesis 1 and theology. We've looked at Genesis 1 and history, Genesis 1 and literature. I just want to touch on Genesis 1 and theology, which on one level sounds redundant, right? Because it's the Bible and it's meant to be about God, isn't it? But there's all kinds of ways that we could talk about God here. We could talk about God's eternity, that there was God in the beginning, and then God spoke, and there's the world, and there's a cosmos. We could talk about something called creation ex nihilo, which means creation out of nothing. We could talk about the fact that every moment is creation ex nihilo, because if God withdrew his word, everything would fall into chaos again. But those aren't the kinds of things, the kinds of questions that Genesis 1 deals with. Now, this is fascinating, and it takes a little bit of unpacking, but let me try and help you to see a different perspective on theological questions, questions concerning God in Genesis 1. The way that God is described throughout this chapter is really, God is portrayed as a priest. God is like a cosmic priest, and the cosmos is like the temple. And God is at work as a priest in his cosmic temple, separating and dividing and blessing and assigning and speaking blessing over things and affirming things. Those are all the kinds of things that Israel's priests did in the temple, separating the common from the holy, assigning things to their proper places, like ministering to God in that sense. That's what the priests did. And this is the way that God is portrayed in his creation. There is something priestly about creation, but not just from a human perspective, from a divine perspective. Creation is like a wonderful temple where God is active, and the very ordering of creation has God's priestly fingerprints on it as he has assigned and distributed and made a context for worship. And so we find in creation that worship is at the very heart of it. The very fiber of the created order has divinely appointed worship right there, because God, as a cosmic priest, has ordained and ordered things in this particular way. And if you lived in Babylon now, If you were one of the exiles who sat down and wept as the Babylonians tormented them and said, sing us one of the songs of Zion, and you said, oh, how can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? Well, Genesis 1 would say this ain't a foreign land. We are able as the people of God to recognize the divine order in all things, even in exile. We get to see that God has not lost, God has not left us, but in fact we get to see and participate in this wonderful worship of God by sharing in his ordering of creation. We can see that there's order and beauty, and that's part of the way that God has designed it. It's part of his sustaining of all things. God as a great priest has acted in this way. And so worship, it's at the heart of the whole of reality. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that singing songs is at the heart of the whole of reality, because priesthood was about far more than that. But what we get to see in Genesis 1 is a snapshot of a God who is not far away, like as though we are on earth and God is in heaven, and if we shout loud enough, we might be able to touch face with him somehow, but it portrays the very shape of reality as ordered by God as a means of participating in worship. You know, perhaps as the Israelites in Babylon, or the ones who were left behind in Judah, perhaps as they reflected on things, perhaps gradually as Genesis 1 is heard or recited or reflected upon, perhaps even something about the way that reality is from Genesis 1's perspective points to the order of our own worship and says, look, it somehow affirms the way that God has done things. Now, our worship as Christians today somehow needs to affirm and restate and say again the things that God has done. It should somehow be ordered and appropriate and draw in the kinds of concerns that God has and that we see in Genesis 1. And so maybe it goes both ways. There is something about creation that has worship at the very heart of it, and there's something about worship that points to the God of creation as well. And by our sharing and participating in that, we share in and participate and reaffirm the ordering of God in his good created world. I said at the beginning that there was barely a more important text for us than Genesis 1 at this time, given our current situation. And I've tried to defibrillate your imagination a bit by showing you this context for the composition of Genesis that can help us enter into the world of Genesis 1 in a fresh way, to see how that context of chaos and turmoil can actually provide a way of hearing Genesis 1 in a new sense. I've tried to show you how the very features of the text itself might be understood as more than just information, but as a participation in God's ordering of all life and reality, and something that presses back against chaos and disorder. And finally, I've tried to show you just one way that the text portrays God for us that might equip us to recognize both the significance of our own worship as a sharing in the reality of God's creative order, and the reality of God as a cosmic priest that allows for us to conceive of our worship in ways that go way, way, way beyond the one-dimensional understanding of worship that we sometimes have as Christians. I know it's all topsy-turvy. I know there are so many question marks about our lives, our futures. I know our hopes and dreams are hanging by the balance in so many ways. I know all the relationships that we have and enjoy are creaking like mad at the moment. I know there's more tears and sighs than ever before in our houses, in the quiet places. So let me urge you and encourage you to read, recite, reflect on this text, on Genesis 1. Don't just stop there, of course, but use this and participate in its portrayal of reality, in the order and the beauty of how it portrays reality, in the God who orders reality in this way. And let's gain hope and strength and courage from that, that our God will again speak and bring light and order into the chaotic, tumultuous places of our lives. God bless you. Have a wonderful rest of the day.